You are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News.
Good evening, folks. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting from west of the west on the coast of the North American continent in the state of California. And today I would like to talk with you a little bit about prolactin and prolactin excess.
Prolactin is a peptide hormone, meaning that it's made of amino acids produced by the prolactin-producing cells or the lactotrophs of the anterior pituitary gland. Prolactin has a number of different functions in human physiology.
The physiological function that's most apparent is that gives it its name. It is pro or otherwise in support of or promotes lactation or breast milk production, release, and letdown, etc. So that seems to be one of the major roles of the drug. However, prolactin plays an important role in our lives even before we're born. Most people don't realize this, but amniotic fluid prolactin concentrations are astronomical, much higher than they are in the bloodstream. And it's believed that prolactin plays a very interesting role in the electrolyte composition of amniotic fluid. In keeping with its role to regulate electrolytes and fluids and sodium and water balance, you might be surprised to find out that prolactin is produced by the pituitary gland of fish as they spawn, and its role in regulating salt and water composition of body fluids is important to allow a fish to swim from salt water to fresh water and vice versa during the spawning process and going out to sea, for example, after having been hatched in fresh water. Prolactin also seems to play a role in modulation of the immune response. Some of us believe that it probably plays a role in intermediary metabolism. One of my colleagues, who's a very well-known pituitary endocrinologist, had remarked to me probably 20 years ago that most of his patients with hyperprolactinemia were overweight, and he thought that the hormone probably had something to do with energy expenditure and basal metabolic rate. And he's probably right. Not everyone with hyperprolactinemia is overweight, but it is a common finding in our patients with hyperprolactinemia. And then lastly, it seems to alter behavior as well. And there have been a number of studies that show that people with hyperprolactinemia are more hostile towards others. And teleologically, this may represent a protective maternal instinct. So, for example, a mother delivers a child and is breastfeeding that child, and the prolactin may contribute to the hostility so that she protects that infant. So that's just a little bit of a background about prolactin itself. Now let's talk about measurement of prolactin levels. Prolactin concentrations vary depending on the method of analysis and the way the results are reported. In the United States, they're reported in nanograms per milliliter, and generally speaking, the laboratory reference range can vary depending on the type of assay that's performed. Usually, I think of prolactin levels less than 20 as normal, and anything is greater than normal as certainly circumspect, and anything greater than 30 is certainly definitely abnormal. It's interesting to understand prolactin assays, so the assay can be affected by a number of different things, one of them being physiological things that can increase prolactin levels. So, for example, a woman should not have a breast exam and a prolactin level on the same day because the breast stimulation and nipple stimulation during the examination would lead to high prolactin. Also, people who are fearful of having blood drawn or are frightened for whatever reasons would probably have mild hyperprolactinemia. It's also said that prolactin levels are higher after eating and that they should be done fasting. In the real world, however, we usually don't do levels fasting because patients may have a 4 o'clock in the afternoon appointment. We certainly don't want them fasting for the intents and purposes of having a prolactin level. It might be more important in that patient who has an elevation in prolactin but no evidence for a tumor, and you wonder what the cause of the hyperprolactinemia might be. But generally speaking, we recommend having your prolactin level done if you're a woman on a day that you do not have a breast examination. Being a peptide hormone, prolactin is a protein, and we can detect proteins in a bloodstream by radioimmunoassay, meaning that there's usually a radioactive tag that's tagged to an antibody. The prolactin assay usually requires a double antibody system to be able to get that level determined carefully. And all levels are determined against a reference range. So somewhere along the way, we determined this is an accurate prolactin level, and then those standards are used to sort of gauge the particular radioimmunoassay and its performance. Unfortunately, the prolactin radioimmunoassay historically has not been all that great. For example, the earlier assays would only detect prolactin levels up to about 200, and after 200, if there was a patient suspected of having a prolactin over 200, you'd have to dilute the sample because the antibodies were overwhelmed by the amount of prolactin in excess of 200. So the problem there would be that a patient would have a prolactin level of maybe 5,000, and the assay might give a report of 120. So a patient with a big tumor, prolactin's really 5,000, the result comes back at 120, and the patient's thought to not have a prolactinoma when indeed they have a prolactin. And this is called the hook effect. And the solution to resolving whether there's a hook effect is to ask the prolactin level to be done on diluted blood samples. So the lab will actually dilute the plasma in varying degrees with saline and then determine prolactin. And ultimately, they can do a multiplication factor and figure out the true value. However, some prolactin assays use a better assay with a higher range. At my institution, for example, they can detect prolactin levels up to 4,000 without having to do a dilution. So it's important to keep that in mind, especially if your physician is using a prolactin determination to determine whether a macroadenoma goes to surgery or is treated with medication because it's a prolactinoma. So if you have a prolactin that's less than 200 in a macroadenoma, ask your doctor whether that sample was diluted. Now, another thing that can affect the prolactin determination is the presence of autoantibodies or an immune set of antibodies against prolactin. And this is something that can lead to what's called macroprolactinemia. And some patients do make antibodies against prolactin that cause the prolactin to clump and not be cleared by the liver and the kidney, and it just accumulates in the bloodstream. But it's a prolactin that's not active. And the laboratory can actually do special tests to determine whether it's macroprolactin, in other words, it's prolactin that's clumped, or the prolactin that's monomeric, meaning it's a single molecule of prolactin. And they can give you a ratio and a percentage, if you would, of the prolactin that's single and the prolactin that's clumped in several different molecules by the antibodies. Those patients who have the macroprolactinemia usually are the ones who have a high prolactin but no breast milk production, normal menses, and no evidence for a pituitary tumor. The one caveat, however, is that some patients with pituitary tumors and some patients with prolactinomas even develop antibodies against prolactin and can have macroprolactinemia. And sometimes the presence of macroprolactinemia can complicate treatment because you might treat a patient with a dopamine agonist drug, see that the prolactin level falls, but not that much, but maybe even the tumor shrinks and the menses come back and the breast milk resolves, but your prolactin is still 40. So when you have that discord between the clinical response and the biochemical test, that would prompt me and should prompt other physicians and you, the patient, to ask for it to determine whether you have macroprolactinemia. Because if your prolactin's only going to get down to 40 because of the antibodies, you don't need to go up on the dose of your medication if you've restored your menses, resolved the breast milk, and regressed the tumor size, for example. So then the hook effect and macroprolactinemia are two things that you need to know about and work with your physicians if you see evidence between the radiological and clinical features that don't seem to make sense or the picture maybe looks cloudy or confusing. One other thing to keep in mind is that the most common cause of a high prolactin level in human beings is pregnancy. So women who aren't having menses and have a high prolactin, especially in the absence of breast milk, they should get a pregnancy test. Prolactin levels in normal pregnancy can go up to 120 on average, with the standard deviation range being up to 600 during a normal pregnancy. But generally speaking, we'll see levels go around 80 to 120 by the end of the third trimester. That information is also useful when following patients who have prolactinomas who are going through a pregnancy, because we can see what's supposed to happen in normal pregnancy, and we pretty much know the pattern of what happens to prolactin during pregnancy in women with prolactinomas, and we can look for evidence that things aren't going as they should that can help us predict whether someone might be having a tumor that's increasing in size during their pregnancy. I just thought of something else I wanted to say about laboratory results before I talk about some of the different causes of hyperprolactinemia, and that is that every single blood test has an inter-assay coefficient of variation and an intra-assay coefficient of variation. And you've all seen this in your laboratory studies. And what that means is that if you have a prolactin level checked at my institution, and then maybe Stanford, which is a little bit south of us, or one of the local community hospitals in our facility, you're going to get different results. You could even take that same blood sample and run it around to several different clinics in the Bay Area or wherever you live and get a different result from every single lab. And that's called an inter-assay coefficient of variation. And that may vary by as much as 20 to 30% depending on the particular laboratory test. And then what's called the intra-assay coefficient of variation. And if you've done radioimmunoassays, you would understand the noise in the system. But the intra-assay means that we could take your sample of blood and run that, say, 10 times, and we will get 10 entirely different results. And there's going to be a variance there that usually is different depending on whether you're looking at a high result, a medium result, or a low result. But those coefficients of variation can be as much as 10 to 20% depending on the particular prolactin level that's being evaluated. So keep that in mind, especially if you're bouncing from your doctor's office to a pituitary center or get several different laboratory results. So the point is that a 37 and a 30, probably not much different. A 250 and a 225, probably not much different, because those are fairly close to the assay variations. If you have a 200 and then go to 120, that's a different level. So it's important to know what the number is, but you know, a 30 is a 35, or a 35 is a 30, for example. And we don't sweat the little small changes like that that are not within the, not outside the limits of the assay variation, so to speak. I'm not sure if that's clear, but that's how we practice medicine, and just wanted you folks to sort of understand that and contemplate that in this era where most patients have access to their laboratory results and sometimes ask me, what does this mean that the level was 37 and now it's 32? It usually means very little in that particular setting. Now, on to a word about prolactin regulation. Prolactin secretion by the pituitary is largely under the influence of the brain through the hypothalamus, making a hormone called dopamine. And dopamine acts to inhibit prolactin secretion by the pituitary gland. Vasoactive intestinal peptide is probably one of the minor stimulators of prolactin release, but generally speaking, prolactin production by the pituitary, it would be full on if it were not for dopamine from the hypothalamus traveling down the pituitary stalk and the portal vessels that are along the stalk, getting into the pituitary, inhibiting prolactin secretion. And that's a very important thing to keep in mind, because our dopamine agonist drugs like cabergoline and bromocriptine act like dopamine. That's what an agonist does. It acts like a particular compound. And those drugs inhibit prolactin secretion, and they will inhibit prolactin secretion regardless of the cause of a hyperprolactinemia in a particular patient. So they're always going to inhibit prolactin by tumors, by a number of different processes that we'll talk about, and in patients who have what we refer to as idiopathic hyperprolactinemia, where we don't understand the cause, they'll work in that situation as well. So that fact about dopamine inhibiting prolactin is important not only in therapy, but also in the evaluation of the hyperprolactinemic patient, because causes of prolactin can be sort of, if you will, generalized to tumors that produce prolactin, and those will be prolactinomas, and then some of the growth hormone secreting tumors also co-secrete prolactin. Tumors that inhibit the delivery of dopamine to the anterior pituitary, which can be a non-functioning tumor affecting blood flow from the pituitary stalk, leading to what we call stalk hyperprolactinemia, or a tumor of the pituitary stalk that doesn't let dopamine get to the pituitary, or a tumor of the hypothalamus that doesn't allow dopamine to be produced to then get to the anterior pituitary. And then, of course, drugs that block the dopamine receptor, they will also lead to hyperprolactinemia because you're not seeing the effect of dopamine on the anterior pituitary gland. So that physiology and perturbations thereof are useful in evaluating particular patients. Now, I've mentioned a couple terms. I mentioned the term stalk hyperprolactinemia and prolactinomas. And let me give you some general rules that we follow as physicians. So if you have a big pituitary tumor and a prolactin level that's greater than 200, in an assay where you know that's the actual prolactin, that usually is a prolactinoma, or a tumor that can secrete prolactin. The caveat to that is, however, that some what we call atypical prolactinomas or acidophil stem cell adenomas are prolactinomas that can be larger than a centimeter and also be associated with prolactin levels less than 200. In some of those patients, their surgery is the best option because some of the acidophil stem cell tumors don't respond well to dopamine agonist drugs as far as shrinkage is concerned. You might get control of the prolactin or partial control. We take those patients to surgeon, we find out it was a prolactinoma and after all, and it was an atypical lesion. But one of those types of tumors associated, big tumor with the association of the prolactin level less than 200. The next caveat is that microprolactinomas or tumors under a centimeter can be associated with any prolactin level. And so I've seen patients with small pituitary tumors that turn out to be prolactinomas because they've gone to surgery, and we know that for a fact, and their prolactin level is 35 or 50 or 70 or what have you. So when it comes to this rule of over 200 definitely a prolactinoma, that only applies to the big tumors. So the smaller tumors, the prolactin can be anything. And this term that I use, stalk hyperprolactinemia, is basically any disorder, whether it be an infiltrative disorder like sarcoidosis or Langerhans cell histiocytosis, or a metastatic tumor, or a tumor of the pituitary stalk or of the posterior pituitary. Those are lesions that interrupt the flow of dopamine to the anterior pituitary gland, and they generally result in prolactin levels somewhere between 60 and 120. It's rare to see them approaching 150. So when we see a lesion that's situated in the hypothalamus or the stalk or the posterior pituitary with modest hyperprolactinemia, we often think about it being stalk effect hyperprolactinemia. A number of other processes can cause hyperprolactinemia. And I suppose one other thing I should talk about is drug-induced hyperprolactinemia, because most of those are the antipsychotic drugs, some of the antidepressants, some antihypertensives, believe it or not, especially verapamil, can also cause hyperprolactinemia. And they usually do so, even some anti-nausea drugs, they do so by interfering with the dopamine receptor and blocking dopamine action. That unrestrains the pituitary and it makes prolactin. And levels here are usually the same that we see in patients who have stalk hyperprolactinemia. So a few other causes, patients who have liver disease, especially cirrhosis, tend not to clear prolactin and can have modest hyperprolactinemia. Those patients who have renal or kidney insufficiency also can have the same problem. People with shingles involving the chest wall or chest tumors, such as a lung tumor involving a rib, for example, have processes that stimulate the suckling reflexes and can have associated hyperprolactinemia. It's even been reported in people who've been in automobile accidents and have chest wall injury that they'll then develop breast milk production from the hyperprolactinemia due to the activation of those reflex arcs that would normally be stimulated during suckling. A very important recognized cause of hyperprolactinemia is that of primary hypothyroidism. Primary meaning there's something wrong with the thyroid gland. So people with Hashimoto's thyroiditis who have had surgery, if their thyroid hormone levels are very low, what happens is that when T4 and T3 levels are low, that results in TRH being produced by the hypothalamus to try to stimulate TSH production by the pituitary gland. And TRH is another weak stimulator of prolactin in patients who have pituitary diseases. And levels have to be pretty high, or thyroid hormone levels have to be pretty low, and the endogenous TRH has to be pretty high to cause this situation. The curious thing is that patients with such profound hypothyroidism who have hyperprolactinemia due to the TRH stimulating the prolactin production also usually have pituitary hyperplasia, or enlargement of the pituitary gland, because the TRH is also revving up TSH stimulation, and TSH is trying to beat the thyroid to make more hormone. So they can get a big pituitary gland, often misread by the radiologist as a tumor, and the prolactin level might be 120, so it fits into that stalk hyperprolactinemia. And a number of patients have gone to surgery and had their pituitary removed when all they needed was thyroid hormone. So we try to teach all of our residents, and now you folks, that if you have hyperprolactinemia and a big pituitary but no definite tumor, you certainly need your thyroid hormone levels checked, because you might have primary thyroid disease accounting for this problem. And then the last thing I'll talk about in regards to causes of hyperprolactinemia is that of idiopathic hyperprolactinemia, where we see hyperprolactinemia and it's not macroprolactinemia and there's no evidence of a pituitary tumor on MRI. And in my experience, most of those patients do have very small pituitary adenomas that are just below the detection limits of the MRI and certainly need to be followed. And certainly if their prolactin level is causing breast milk production or abnormal periods, we would treat with dopamine agonist drug to control things, even though we don't see the tumor. Autopsy studies say, and people killed in car accidents, show that maybe 1 in 5, as high as 27% in one study, of us human beings do have a pituitary adenoma, and 40% of those are prolactinomas when they do immunochemistry of those tumors they find. And most of those tumors are 1 to 3 millimeters in size, and those are not going to be seen on MRI. And occasionally we're going to see a patient who has abnormal menses or maybe breast milk production and has an MRI that does not show a tumor, but the prolactin's 40. And to me, those idiopathic hyperprolactinemic patients probably do harbor small pituitary tumors that our MRIs can't resolve because they're so small. All right, so that's a whirlwind off the top of my head, just speaking what comes to mind, review of hyperprolactinemia. In a future podcast, I'll talk a little bit more about prolactinomas and the different treatment alternatives and the expected responses to the different dopamine agonist drugs. That's it for now. Once again, Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, and have a wonderful evening.